It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Steph, and this is Not Today. Hello, and welcome back. Or welcome. If you're new here, we talk about some really unbelievable stories. And by we, I guess I mean me today. I am going to be telling you a story because Alex isn't here. But before we jump in, I did want to remind everyone that if you enjoy the show, we do have a bunch of bonus content over on Patreon, and you get to vote on the stories you want to hear every single month. And it's generally a good time, I would say. We chat, we discuss, and we'd love to have you. When this episode comes out, there should be a poll up over on Patreon. So, like I said, our patrons do get to vote on stories they want to hear. And I don't know what the poll will be in this moment because I haven't figured it out yet. But by the time this episode comes out, there will be a poll up. So if you want to vote on a story and hear a bunch of extra bonus content, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. And yeah. Okay, shameless self-plug over. How are we feeling? I hope the answer is good, but to be honest, I don't even know how I'm feeling right now, because to be completely honest with you, this story is a lot. It's not going to be a light one. I just wanted to put that out there at the top. So we're going to be talking about Australia's most notorious serial killer today, Ivan Milat, and let's just say that he did not get that title lightly. So I am going to be talking about his very terrifying and violent crimes. And I have obviously told a lot of stories and heard a lot of stories, but I had never heard of anything quite like this. And I'm referring to one specific detail about his murders and what he would do to his victims. But yeah, this one really got to me. And I was surprised that I had never even heard of him, because this is such a big case. But anyway, I don't think I have anything left to say at the top, so I guess let's just jump in. Ivan Robert Marco Milat was born on December 27, 1944, near Sydney, Australia. He was the fifth of 14 children in his family, so 10 boys and 4 girls, which is a huge family, and knowing just that number alone, we can speculate that as a child, Ivan didn't get as much attention as he may have needed, because purely from a practical standpoint, you couldn't possibly give 14 children all of your attention. So Ivan's parents were Margaret Hiddleston, who was Australian, and Stephen Milat, who was Croatian, and Stephen married Margaret when she was only 16 years old. The Milats had a dysfunctional upbringing. The family kind of isolated themselves, and since they were such a large family, there wasn't really any need to branch out. The family was also very poor and uneducated. The Milats were an intense bunch, because many kids grew up playing cowboys with fake guns, but the Milats played with real guns. And Ivan's siblings have said that their father was brutally violent toward them and was the major disciplinarian, especially with his sons. Ivan and his brothers were constantly in trouble with not only their parents, but also the local police. The police that had to deal with the Milats definitely had their hands full. Their mother occasionally would beat them, but for the most part, she was someone they could be safe with. And Ivan was definitely one of her favorites. He was a mommy's boy, and she didn't believe anything bad about her family. So they kind of had this weird combination of constantly getting in trouble and being beaten by their father, but then their mother telling them that they could do no wrong. I'm sure very confusing for a child. And obviously, traumatizing. Also, just a side note, when I was researching this family, the only thing I could picture was the Milkovich family from Shameless, for anyone who has watched Shameless. I'm sure they are very different, but it was giving that vibe. But from a very young age, his brothers said that they knew Ivan was different. Ivan was constantly fighting with his brothers, and specifically had a lot of conflict with his brother George, regularly blowing up at him over anything. By the age of 10, he was already showing signs of psychopathic personality. His brother Boris said that Ivan was very deceitful, and his brother George said that if he had a dollar for every time Ivan snapped, he'd be a millionaire. And crazily enough, they said they knew that he was kind of destined to kill somebody, which kind of wasn't a crazy assumption to make because as a young child, he killed a dog in a really horrifying way with a machete. He also talked with an acquaintance about turning a person into a head on a stick by stabbing them in the spine. Normal children activities. Another thing about the Malats is that they were obsessed with guns, and even when they were made illegal for a time, they refused to give them up. They even constructed their own shooting range, and Ivan in particular was the best shot out of all of them. He was obsessed with guns and collected them. The guns made him feel really powerful, and he saw himself as an outlaw. Ivan did leave school after 8th grade at the age of 15 and got a job welding chicken cages, and he was actually a pretty good worker. He enjoyed riding motorbikes, camping, knives, and shooting his guns, which was a skill he would use later in his life in a very horrific way. Things changed for the Malat family when Ivan's younger sister Margaret tragically died in a gruesome car accident that Ivan actually witnessed. 2 weeks later, Margaret died, and this left Ivan very traumatized. It seemed like after the crash, something was triggered in Ivan because he became a lot more violent and began killing more animals. But like I said, despite Ivan's trouble with the law, he was a good worker. For about a year, he worked for Peter Cantarella at his local fruit shop, and since he had been such a good employee, Peter agreed to co-sign a loan for Ivan to buy a car. But once Ivan had the car, he stopped showing up for work, and he stopped making payments on the loan, which meant that it fell all on Peter as the co-signer. He definitely manipulated Peter to get what he wanted, and he was just manipulative in general, which was another common characteristic of psychopathic personality and of serial killers. And if that wasn't bad enough, Ivan and his brothers would terrorize Peter and his wife, constantly riding by his shop and throwing rocks at him and his store, causing property damage. And of course, Ivan is not only just a terrible human being, but truly evil, so I shouldn't be surprised that he's treating his employer this way, but I do feel bad for Peter because he just did a really nice thing for a kid that worked for him, and he did not deserve that. Just like every other person in the story did not deserve what happened to them, but like I said, Ivan is evil. So this is like the least terrible thing he's done in his whole life.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
When Ivan was 17, he was caught stealing and was placed in a juvenile detention center. But that wasn't the only trouble he got into at that age. On the evening of March 6, 1962, he got a ride in a cab from a man named Neville Knight. 17-year-old Ivan Malat aimed a shotgun at Neville without any warning and fired a shot right into his back, immediately paralyzing Neville. The next morning, Ivan told his brother Boris what he had done, not because he felt guilty and wanted to confess to somebody, but because he was pleased with himself. Boris was only 12 years old at the time, but he knew that Ivan had no empathy, and shooting Neville brought him joy. He described in great detail how easy it was to pull the trigger and the cab driver's screams. And Ivan wasn't caught for that crime, because the police suspected a different boy, and that boy's brother, Alan, falsely confessed to protect his brother and ended up doing 5 years in jail for it. And Boris never said anything. In fact, he wouldn't confess that he knew anything about this crime until 50 years later. But that didn't stop Ivan from getting in trouble. He was sent to jail for 18 months for breaking and entering, and then was sent back only a month after he had finished that sentence for driving a stolen vehicle, and was sentenced to 2 years of hard labor. Once he finished that up, he was arrested again for theft and sentenced to 3 more years. So Ivan had become a career criminal. And he was still very young. He was in his 20s by that point. But he had spent a lot of his really formative years with criminals. In his case, and I'm sure many other kids' cases, the juvenile detention center didn't necessarily rehabilitate Ivan. It just gave him an education in being a criminal. He was just learning from his quote-unquote peers, and he came out worse than when he went in. In April of 1971, Ivan committed his next violent crime. He was at a train station near Liverpool watching passengers depart a train when he spotted two young women who he offered a ride to. Both girls were 18 years old and were happy to accept the ride since he must have come off as non-threatening. But once the girls got in his car, he threatened them with a knife and told them if they screamed, he would slit their throats. Which is immediately terrifying. He then took them into the forest where he bound and gagged them, but somehow they managed to convince Ivan not to kill them. Ivan did rape one of the women and then took them back to the car. And when they got back on the road, they, again, somehow convinced Ivan to pull over at a gas station so they could get a drink. And shockingly, he agreed to and even allowed them to both go into the gas station together. And as soon as they got inside, they, of course, immediately alerted the attendant and asked for help, explaining that the man in the parking lot had kidnapped and raped them. But before this gas station attendant could run out and get to Ivan, he managed to drive away and make his escape. Based on the description of his car and himself, he was tracked down and arrested on 2 counts of kidnapping and 1 count of rape. But while he waited for trial, he and his brothers continued to commit crimes, like robberies. Because he clearly didn't care if he went to jail. He had already done a couple of stints, and this wasn't an unheard of thing for the Malats. George would regularly visit his brothers in jail, including Boris, Michael, Billy, and Ivan. But Ivan decided that he didn't want to go back to jail, so his solution to this problem was to fake his own death. He left a pair of his shoes at The Gap, which was the edge of this oceanside cliff in Sydney where many people commit suicide. He then fled to New Zealand, where he stayed until 1974. He ended up returning home when he found out his mother was sick and in the hospital, which was when the police rearrested him and he had his trial. So he managed to escape his trial for a few years, but 1974 rolled around and here he was. And unsurprisingly, Ivan denied everything. And because there wasn't enough evidence, he was acquitted of those crimes. Which makes my blood boil. But unfortunately for these girls, this was something that has happened to many other women before them and was now happening to them. So he got away. And from that experience, Ivan learned that he couldn't leave behind any witnesses. At that point, Ivan moved back in with his parents and got a job as an interstate truck driver. He then met a girl named Karen. He was 30 at the time, and she was 17 and 6 weeks pregnant with another man's baby who was actually Ivan's cousin Mark. Which is quite the sentence. But Ivan is no stranger to sleeping with his family's girlfriends and wives. In fact, he slept with multiple of his brother's wives. So eventually, Karen and Ivan moved in together, Karen had her son, and in the mid-1980s, they got married with none of Ivan's family present, because as I'm sure you can imagine, this caused some familial tension. And not because she was 17, which is absolutely gross, but because she was having Ivan's cousin's baby. Insane. So during that time, the Malat family was very strained, and Ivan's father died of bowel cancer, and Ivan's brother David was brain damaged after a motorcycle accident. But Ivan got a job working for the Department of Main Roads, which took him away from his family for multiple days a week, and he never left the house without being perfectly groomed and neatly dressed. He was kind of weird in that way. He never drank, nor did he smoke, and he cared about his appearance a lot. He also insisted on keeping a clean and orderly home, and he loved his Harley-Davidson motorcycle and took very good care of it. He liked to paint model trains and cars with camo print, and he started painting his guns the same way. But Ivan didn't suddenly become wholesome. He was a massive piece of shit. He just was a piece of shit who needed to be in control of everything, including his wife. And that behavior escalated into Ivan physically abusing his wife. And at the same time, Ivan had another affair with his brother Walter's wife, Maureen. And how he managed to get all these women to sleep with him is beyond me. But despite the cheating, Karen stayed with Ivan. But Ivan became more manipulative, violent, and controlling. She wasn't allowed to leave their house until she told him exactly where she was going and when she would return, and she needed to supply receipts for anything she bought. All while Ivan was literally playing dress-up like a cowboy, complete with a hat and sheriff's badge. He called himself Tex when he dressed up. Karen never knew what to expect, because there would be stretches of time where Ivan was in a good mood and he would leave her alone, and then out of nowhere, he would beat her again. One time it was so bad, his mother even called the police on him. And Karen was a nervous wreck. She did eventually leave Ivan, packing up and leaving with her mother one afternoon while Ivan was away for work. But when he found out, he went to Karen's parents' house and set it on fire, burning down the entire front of the house. But thankfully, by the end of 1989, Karen and Ivan were finally divorced, and he hated her for that, especially because she was able to claim a portion of his income. So because of that, Ivan quit his job and started working under a fake name to avoid having to pay spousal support, which is the least shocking thing he's ever done because he literally faked his death. I guess you can't fake your death twice. Ivan once again was working as a road worker, so he was working all over the place and was constantly moving around. And he always brought his gun with him, everywhere he went, even to work. And unsurprisingly, while Ivan's coworkers hung out and got drinks together after work, Ivan was a complete loner. He was also extremely sus. He would leave work for extended periods of time, giving nobody any clue as to where he was going or what he was doing, and would ask for others to cover for him. But at the same time, part of his job was delivering truck tires, so he did spend a lot of his time alone doing that. And because he was traveling around so much, his job made it very easy for him to pick up hitchhikers and backpackers along the way. Usually, they were one and the same. In the late 80s and early 90s, backpacking in Australia was very popular for people in their late teens to mid-20s. People who were doing that, of course, were looking for some adventure, and so backpacking, especially at that time, kind of went hand in hand with hitchhiking. It was also very common for people to be backpacking on their own or with one other friend they made along the way, and to take on odd jobs to make some money to fund their inexpensive travel. And hitchhiking, for the most part, was seen as a pretty safe option of travel. So on December 30th, 1989, Ivan picked up two hitchhikers from Melbourne, James Gibson and Deborah Everest. It was Deborah's first trip out of Melbourne. Both were 19 and planned to hitchhike with friends to a border town to attend the Confest, which I believe is a five-day camping festival. But unfortunately for the two of them, there was a bit of a mix-up with their friends, and they ended up leaving without them. So now James and Deborah had to travel on their own. And Ivan wasted no time. After he picked them up, he drove them to the Belanglo State Forest, where he violently tortured and murdered them. James was stabbed through his upper spine, leaving him paralyzed, before he was stabbed seven more times in his back and chest, puncturing his heart and lungs. Deborah met a similar but possibly worse fate. She was bound and beaten before he stabbed her in the back like he had James. He broke her jaw, stabbed her in the skull, fracturing it in two places, and then dismembered her body and scattered her body parts all around the area. And for most of Ivan's victims, these were not quick murders. As we will come to find, his signature in these murders is that he would paralyze his victims. Because he wanted complete control over them, and he wanted them to not be able to fight back. It is horrifying, and I don't even know how to wrap my head around it, but that is what he would do. And the Belanglo State Forest was absolutely massive and isolated. The forest was also within an hour of his house, so it was an area he knew well, and it had become his hunting ground. Backpackers were also a very easy target for him because he knew that most of their families would likely not know that they were missing for weeks or even months after he killed them because they were traveling and the families weren't expecting a call. Ivan was a monster, and this was all a game to him.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com.
Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
James's belongings were actually found. His backpack and camera were found in Golston Gorge, Sydney, shortly after he had disappeared, but they had just been abandoned on the side of the road, so people didn't really know what to make of them. About a month later, on January 25th, 1990, a 24-year-old British backpacker named Paul Onions was looking for a ride from Liverpool to Melbourne. He had spent 5 years in the Royal Navy and was taking this trip to see Australia and have a nice, needed break. He planned to work as a fruit picker to make money, and like most people in his shoes, he viewed hitchhiking as a very safe way to travel. And Ivan spotted Paul right after he had purchased a drink on his route and offered him a ride. He introduced himself as Bill, and Paul, who had been looking for a ride all day, accepted the ride happily. Bill seemed cool enough, and he wanted to get where he was going. But once they got on the road, Bill began chatting and making some racist comments that made Paul feel very uncomfortable, but there wasn't very much he could do other than sit there. He was already in the car. He thought he had just gotten a ride from a crazy man, and boy was he right. About 60 miles from where Onions was picked up, he noticed Bill slowing down and checking the rearview mirror. When he asked what the problem was, Ivan said they were losing radio signal, and he was going to pull over to grab some cassette tapes from under his seat. So he pulled over at the entrance of Belanglo State Forest. And Paul was starting to feel very weird about the situation, because from what he had seen, there were cassette tapes in the center console, so he didn't know why this quote-unquote Bill had to pull over and get cassette tapes from another spot in the car. But like I said, the Belanglo State Forest is a place where you can disappear very easily, and Paul was starting to really assess his surroundings. And the energy was very off at that point. Paul opened up the door to stretch his legs, which was when Ivan snapped at him, yelling that he needed to get back into the car and shut the door. And kind of surprised, Paul did as he was told, and for a second felt a little relief when he saw Bill get back into the car as well. But the relief faded very quickly when Ivan hopped back out, pulled a handgun out from under the seat, and pointed it at Paul. Paul put his hands up and tried to reason with Bill, but again, to his shock and horror, he saw that Bill had a rope in his hands, which to him was even more terrifying than the gun. That meant that Bill wasn't going to just kill him, he was going to do whatever he wanted. And in the same second, Paul made the decision to throw the door open and start running onto the busy highway. As Paul ran as fast as he could into traffic, desperate to stop a car, Ivan was chasing right behind him with his gun drawn and shooting at him. Ivan managed to catch up to Paul and he grabbed him, and the two began wrestling in the middle of the highway as cars swerved around them. Can you imagine seeing that as you drive by? Also, I was thinking about, as a driver, if you see someone in the middle of the highway trying to flag down your car, that's a scary situation. I don't know that I would feel safe enough to stop. But that's how the people who were driving by Paul felt, which was really bad for his situation because he needed help desperately. So, like I said, they were wrestling in the middle of the highway, and thankfully Paul got away once again and he started running as Ivan shot at him. So he started zigzagging as he sprinted to avoid getting shot in the middle of the road. A few cars sped by, none of them stopping for Paul, and Ivan was getting closer. So Paul knew that he had to stop the next car, otherwise he would be dead. He was so desperate, he thought to himself, even if this car runs him over, it would be better than whatever Ivan was about to do to him. At least that death would be pretty quick. And in that moment, a woman named Joanne Berry just so happened to be the next car coming down the road. And in the car with her was her sister and their combined 5 children. But Paul jumped directly in front of the car, and Joanne had no choice but to come to a screeching halt right before she hit him. Paul immediately ran around to the sliding door on her car and yanked it open and got inside as he screamed in a complete panic for them to drive. Joanne was worried about the kid's safety and told Paul to leave them alone, but he screamed, "Help me, he's got a gun," which was clear enough So Joan very quickly backed the car up and drove back the way she came. Before driving off, Paul looked back and saw the look in Ivan's eyes, and he knew that that man would have killed him if he hadn't jumped in this woman's car. It was also strange because Ivan was smirking at him. After hearing Paul's story, Joanne was so thankful she stopped, and she took Paul directly to the nearest police station, where he gave a statement to a police officer, along with Joanne. But shockingly, nothing happened with that information that was given to police. They told him, without the license plate or the man's last name, they were unlikely to catch the man because they believed him to just be a mugger. The most Paul got out of that interaction was $7 to get back to the British Embassy in Sydney to help him get a new passport, since he had left his backpack behind in Ivan's car, which had his personal letters and his passport inside. I'd like to say I'm surprised, but I feel like this happens to so many people. Especially at that time. People just were not taken seriously. Which is a damn shame, because if they did take him seriously and looked into this literal attempted murder, because that's what it was, he had a gun drawn on him and he was shot at multiple times and wrestled in the middle of the road. Like, this man was going to kill him. So if they treated that with the severity that it deserved, then there is a world in which they found Ivan Milat and they stopped him dead in his tracks, which would have saved a lot of lives. So that really sucks. Paul's trip through Australia did continue with his girlfriend, but for weeks afterward, he was so anxious that he would get physically sick. And I don't know how you could have any other reaction other than that. He was haunted by what had happened, and he felt like this man had done this before and would probably do it again. But he did all he could. He went to the police and he made a statement. There was really nothing else he could do. And because Paul had gotten away and Ivan knew it, he felt like it was probably better he lay low for a little while, and he waited almost a full year before striking again. But on January 20th, 1991, Ivan picked up 21-year-old German tourist Simone Schmiedel. Simone was traveling alone from Sydney to Melbourne to meet her mother off of a plane from Munich. The two were planning on having a trip together, and they were both really excited. Simone was an outgoing, adventurous woman, and she wanted to get to Melbourne as quickly as possible. She did carry a knife for protection, so she had safety in mind, but it seems as if this knife was her security blanket because she felt fine hitchhiking alone. When Ivan came along and offered her a ride, she happily accepted. But Ivan did what he always had and took her to the Belanglo State Forest to torture her. Ivan kept Simone alive for quite a while, escalating his violence as time went on. She was stabbed at least 8 times before her fatal stab wound, and he severed her spine in 2 places, paralyzing her. He left her out there, 3.1 miles away from where he left his first murder victims, Deborah Everest and James Gibson. And her mother knew that Simone never would have stood her up for their trip, so she immediately felt like something was wrong. She stayed in Australia for 6 weeks, just hoping her daughter would show up, but she never did. And once again, after the attack, Ivan waited another year before picking up his next victims on December 26, 1991. They were young German backpackers as well, 21-year-old Anja Habschied and Gabor Neugebauer. I apologize in advance if I pronounced those wrong. The two had just spent their break in Bali and decided to head down to Bondi Beach for Christmas. They were expected home in early January of 1992. Ivan picked the pair up as they were leaving a hostel in King's Cross when they were on their way to Mildura. He then took them to the forest where he shot Gabor in the head 6 times and then decapitated Anya. He buried their bodies in shallow graves in the forest. A few months later, on April 18, 1992, 2 British backpackers, 22-year-old Joanne Walters and 21-year-old Caroline Clark, were seen for the last time leaving King's Cross. Both women were smart and adventurous, and were backpacking in King's Cross when they met and decided to keep traveling together. Like Paul Onions and many others, their plan was to pick fruit in Victoria to make money along the way. Caroline's family had warned her about the dangers of hitchhiking, but since the girls were traveling together, they felt safe enough and accepted the ride from Ivan. Ivan, of course, took them to the forest. He raped both of the women, and it's believed that he used Caroline as target practice, shooting her 10 times in the head. Joanne was stabbed 14 times with 9 stab wounds to her back, which would have paralyzed her. After he murdered them, Ivan took a shirt that belonged to Caroline and gave it to his girlfriend at the time. I don't know why that was a shocking piece of information to me, but it just seems like the very ridiculous cherry on top. 6 weeks later, Caroline's family expected to receive a call from her for her sister's birthday. She checked in on her family often and always called home on special occasions. So when Caroline didn't call, her family became very worried and immediately called Australian police and began contacting hostels around Australia. They sent stacks of flyers to these hostels and asked them to pass them out to anyone that would have come through. And soon the flyers were all over Australia and the search for the missing girls continued. But as the weeks turned into months, things were not looking good. On September 19, 1992, two joggers were on a trail in Belanglo State Forest when they were stopped in their tracks by a very foul smell. They followed it just 10 feet off the trail, which was when they found the body of Joanne Walters. Police were contacted and the search began immediately. The next day, they discovered the body of Caroline Clark about 100 feet away from where Joanne was found. Police informed the families and also recovered Winchester bullet casings at the scene, and they found a crude brick fire had been built. And from what they could tell, they knew that these girls had been tortured and executed. But beyond that, there was no other evidence, so the case went cold. And I can't believe that, because these girls were murdered in such a brutal, violent way. And whoever did it is out there. And also keep in mind that there have been multiple backpackers that have been reported missing by this point, because even though it took some of the families a little while to realize that their loved one had been missing, they did notice at some point. And also there were a couple family members who recognized that their loved one was missing immediately and had reported them missing. So from the police standpoint, it's like, okay, you're finding backpackers killed in a crazy way in the forest, and there are multiple others that have just straight up vanished. Maybe this is a bigger story. I don't know if they just hadn't pieced that together, but that's a crazy thing to not piece together. I mean, also, hindsight is 20/20, and it seems very clear from where I'm sitting, but who knows? Bruce Pryor was a local man who had been following the case of the missing women, and he went into the forest often and knew the trails well. So when he heard that the search for additional evidence had been called off, he decided that he was going to walk around the area more deliberately and keep a close eye out for things. He also had heard the reports of other missing backpackers in the area, so he wasn't quite sure what he was looking for, but he wanted to help. And on October 5th, 1993, while Bruce was out there gathering firewood, he found something that caught his eye. It was white and round, and as he walked closer, he realized that it was a human skull. Bruce picked it up and brought it back to his car, where he then contacted police and another search began. And I love the effort and enthusiasm by Bruce, but rule number one is do not disturb the crime scene. But still, I love where his heart was at, so we'll forgive him for this one. And this time when investigators came in, they set up a perimeter, and it wasn't long before they found another body. The skull had belonged to Deborah Everest, and the body they found was 24 yards away, and that was James Gibson. They were about a half a mile away from where the first bodies had been found. But police were perplexed because James's backpack had been found 75 miles away in Sydney, so why was his body here in the forest? At that point, a task force of detectives and analysts was formed, and they started searching more thoroughly. Any spot they could physically get to, they searched. Officers were on their hands and knees sifting through debris on the ground, and they walked side by side to make sure no area was missed. And on November 1st, 1993, they found another body and another crude fire pit that had been built nearby. This one was 3.1 miles away from the bodies that had been found a month before. And through dental records, they were able to confirm that the body had been that of Simone Schmiedel. They also found clothes at the scene, but it wasn't Simone's clothes. It was Anya Habschied's. But it was another 3 days before they found Anya and Gabor's bodies. So at that point, they can link all of these crime scenes together, and police announced that they were looking for a serial killer. Most of the bodies had been found face down with their hands tied behind their backs, with piles of leaves and sticks and furs on their bodies. And based on their injuries, they could tell that these backpackers had been tortured, many of which were paralyzed and were probably kept alive for a while before they were finally killed. So police knew the person who had done this enjoyed having completely vulnerable victims who couldn't fight back. They also found beer bottles around the bodies. And we knew he enjoyed killing, but it seemed as if he was kicking back with a beer in these environments. And then in one of the crime scenes, he used the bottles for target practice along with his victim. It's really too terrible to even imagine the fear that he made his victims endure. And at the beginning, when I said that there was one part of this case that specifically really got to me, that was the paralyzing aspect, that he would cut his victims' spines so that they were still alive, but unable to move. It's one of the worst things I could think about, to be honest. So the story made international news, and the authorities offered $500,000 Australian dollars for information leading to the serial killer. Germany and England covered the story extensively since the backpackers found had come from both countries. And because of that, police got a very unexpected phone call from a man claiming to know who was responsible. Paul Onions told police he had been in Australia almost 3 years prior when he was picked up by a man who said his name was Bill, but he took him near Belanglo State Forest and pulled a gun on him. Paul Onions, who was back in the UK, saw on the news that there had been an investigation into a bunch of missing backpackers in Australia, and immediately he felt like he may have encountered the man responsible. So he contacted investigators and told them to look into his initial police report. So they did that, and they flew Paul out to talk to them because he said he very well may be able to identify the man who did that.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Police had used technology to really help them narrow down the list of suspects, so at that time they had 32 suspects, and they showed Paul a lineup of photos, and he was able to point out Ivan Milat. Investigators had already been looking into Ivan, and unbeknownst to Paul, he was their prime suspect. One of the investigators was, I believe, around the Milat family when they were younger and constantly getting into trouble, and he remembered the two 18-year-old girls Ivan had kidnapped and raped, and he thought that they should look into him. Also, he had been working doing road construction and repair in the areas where various hitchhikers had disappeared. So he seemed like their very good suspect to begin with, but now that Paul had confirmed their suspicions, they began extensive surveillance on Ivan's home in Eaglevale. It was also really quickly figured out that Ivan had sold his vehicle just following the news that remains had been found in the Belanglo State Forest. And investigators learned about his obsession with guns and knives, and they knew about his very violent past. So they're piecing it all together, and they're like, okay, very convenient that you sold your car to potentially get rid of evidence. Like, you're not really being too slick about it, Ivan. Maureen and Ivan's brother, Wally, had been divorced for a while, but detectives still knocked on her door to ask her questions. She had no idea what had been going on, and when police approached her asking about Ivan, she assumed it had been some robberies that he had committed. But she gave police a photo of her and Ivan standing in front of his car, and the photo had been taken in January of 1991, just 11 days before Ivan would use that same car to abduct Simone Schmiedel before murdering her. And when Maureen learned that, she was extremely disturbed and upset, and even remembered a very chilling piece of advice Ivan gave her that day. He told her, "Kids hitchhike. They shouldn't, because there might be rat bags on the road like me." And she completely wrote off that comment, because why would she think twice about that? But I think she even made a joke, saying like, "Oh, like, you can pick him up because you're fine," or something. I don't even know. But it was just a very eerie realization. And especially looking back at that picture of her standing in front of this car, smiling with Ivan, knowing that only a few days later he used it to brutally murder a woman. It's a lot for any person. Finally, on May 22, 1994, Ivan was arrested, and he denied everything he did. However, he did incriminate his younger brother, Richard, in the interview. He was like, "Oh, I didn't do it. Richard did." Also, Ivan had been living with his younger sister, Sydney, at the time, and this is a complete side note, it was alleged that they had an incestuous relationship, so that's gross, but inside Ivan's home, they found a treasure trove of evidence. Gun parts from the murder weapon, a cavalry sword, electrical tape, and items from the victims like backpacks, sleeping bags, wallets, cameras, clothing, and many things had their names on it, some of which had been concealed in the walls and ceiling of his home. Police also found a photo of Ivan holding a sleeping bag that belonged to one of the victims. Police also found more evidence in the homes of Ivan's mother and two brothers, Wally and Richard, who denied any involvement. Police were able to charge Ivan with so many things, from Paul Onion's abduction and attempted murder to the 7 murders that he had committed. And at trial, Ivan's lawyer argued that police had arrested the wrong family member. They didn't argue that the backpackers hadn't been murdered by a Malat, he just said they had the wrong Malat. They suggested the evidence had been planted at Ivan's house, which could have theoretically planted some doubt, but Paul Onions was sure that it was Ivan, and there were literal photos of Ivan with the evidence in his hands. So there really wasn't any getting out of that. But Richard Malat did have some pretty damning evidence found in his home. Caroline Clark's sleeping bag had been found. Her sleeping bag cover, her mat, and her tent were all found in Richard's garden shed. Joanne Walter's sleeping things were also found in a cupboard in his home as well. And Richard said he can't explain it. He said he wasn't sure how it got there, but he also wouldn't accept that it looked bad for him since it was there. And lucky for Richard, the evidence Ivan did it was overwhelming. They found so much evidence, there was no denying that Ivan had done it. Paul Onions did go on the stand to give his evidence and told the courtroom that Ivan Malat was absolutely his abductor, which definitely helped. But a pathologist also testified and said it seemed as if Ivan had not acted alone in the killings. Chief Justice Murray Gleason also said, quote, "Bearing in mind that some of the victims were traveling in pairs and having regard to the way in which they appeared to have been bound or otherwise restrained, it was possible that more than one person was involved. But it was kind of difficult for detectives to determine the exact cause of death of the victims because they only had skeletal remains. What they did know was that the injuries were very severe and very different from body to body." There was that possibility, but the lead investigator in the case also maintained that there was only one killer, and there wasn't enough evidence to charge anyone else. Also, plenty of other serial killers have acted alone. Ivan very easily could have overtaken two people, especially because he had a gun on him. But if there was a second person, it has been theorized that this person likely would have been submissive to Ivan, potentially like a younger brother or sister, like Richard. Despite Richard insisting he had nothing to do with it, he allegedly had boasted to a few people about being involved, and as we know, some of the victim's belongings were found on his property. but we will never have that fully confirmed. The problem with the Malats is that they aren't known for being a truthful bunch. Richard has confirmed that the family code has always been, if you can't think of anything to say, think of a good lie. So there's that. Despite the judge believing Ivan hadn't acted alone, he was the only one found guilty on all counts, and he was given 7 life sentences without the possibility of parole. And something really gross is that the majority of the Malat family continued to maintain his innocence. The Malats are a very intense, hard-headed family, and they stick together to the bitter end. At least most of them. Some of them completely denounced Ivan, and I can agree with that. So Ivan was charged with murdering 7 victims. However, the real victim count is believed to be much higher. In 1993, New South Wales homicide detectives reopened several cases involving 58 missing young people. Many of the young female victims were murdered in the late 1970s during a time when Malat was working as a road worker and stayed in hotels around the same areas. He was considered a suspect as the bodies were discovered partially buried and a .22 caliber rifle found close by, which was a very similar crime scene to Malat's convicted cases. So it's highly possible that he did way more than 7 murders. Those are just the 7 we know about. In May of 1997, Malat attempted to escape prison with another inmate named George Savas. George was a famous Sydney drug lord and had actually already escaped from prison one time before. But this time their plan was foiled because the police had somehow discovered their plan. And because of that, Malat was moved to a supermax prison. While he was there, he also sawed off his pinky with a plastic serrated knife to send it to the High Court because he wanted an appeal. Don't know how he got there. Also, a plastic knife. Psychopaths have been known to have a much higher pain tolerance than other people, so that could have played a part. And in 2011, he went on a hunger strike because he was refused a PlayStation. So, it's pathetic, to be honest. Ivan never admitted his guilt, and he took it to his grave because in prison he died of esophageal cancer in 2019 at the age of 74. And like I said earlier, these murders are something that I can't fully wrap my head around. The brutality and the evil that went into this is mind-boggling. And as someone who has listened to a lot of true crime, it's sometimes easy to listen to these cases like it's just a story, but also, you have to stop and remember that these were real people. And my heart goes out to the families of the deceased because it's unimaginable what their loved ones had to go through and what they must go through. It's one of the most terrifying and awful things I could ever imagine. Ooh, yeah, this one really got to me. On July 18th, 2005, John Marsden, Malat's former lawyer, made a deathbed statement in which he claimed that Malat had been assisted by his sister, Shirley, who apparently died in 2003, in the killings of 2 British backpackers. And according to his brother, Ivan used his younger sister as an accomplice, revealing Shirley was in on it. I can't really say Shirley did commit the murders. All I do say is that she was involved. And Shirley had been fined $1,000 for hiding a gun during the investigation, so it's not very far-fetched. It's also highly possible that Richard was involved too, in my opinion. A memorial was erected at the back of Belanglo State Park, actually months before they even located the killer, and apparently you couldn't find it unless you really looked for it. It has been described as a painfully inadequate tribute to 7 lives. Belanglo's legacy became further twisted in November of 2010 when Ivan Malat's nephew, teenager Matthew Malat, lured a school friend named David Ochterlony to Belanglo with the promise of weed and drink for the kid's birthday. David went along, only to be murdered with an axe. And Matthew was later sentenced to 43 years in jail. And Matthew Malat allegedly told his friends he was just doing, quote, what his family does. The day after, he even bragged, "Do you know what my family is known for? I killed somebody last night." Which is absolutely insane. I mean, what is in the water that they're giving to the Malats? I cannot imagine. I mean, like I said, there were so many of the Malat siblings and extended family that completely believed Ivan when he said that he didn't do it. And, I mean, maybe they just knew that he did and were just covering his ass, because it seems like you can do anything in that family and they will pretty much have your back. But I can't imagine having an uncle, having this man be my uncle, and then at the same time being like, oh, this is just what my family does. Now I'm going to go do it. I know teenagers are stupid, but how stupid can you be? I mean, that goes beyond stupid. That goes into evil as well. It's really just insane. But to not end the story on a completely just awful note, I don't have any more information on Paul Onions, but it's thanks to him that police were able to arrest Ivan Milat when they did, and his testimony was huge for the case. So I wish him well, and I hope that he is chilling out somewhere, because he deserves it. But oh my God, what a case. Whew, I feel like we should all take a big breath after that one. Yeah, I feel like I don't even know what else to say about it. I just hope that no other person ever has to experience the fear and brutality that the victims of Ivan Milat did. And I hope that the Milat family chills out. But oh my God, I feel like I need to like sage and cleanse out my brain after this story. But yeah, that's all I really have to say about that, and all I really want to say about that. So why don't we move on to a bit of a palate cleanser? If you're new here, at the end of our stories, I like to close this out with a completely separate topic. That way we can kind of restart fresh before we go back into the world as normal people. So I'm going to tell you something good, and my good thing is really exciting this week. I can say this now because this episode will be coming out after it happens, but my friends are going to be getting engaged. We're dropping like flies over here. And as exciting as it is to be on the receiving end of an engagement, I am also very excited to be on the planning side and know all the secrets and have like secret FaceTimes that we can't tell anyone about because it's a surprise. So I'm typically not very good at surprises because I just get too excited and I like to spill them. But obviously that didn't happen in this scenario. So yeah, it's just going to be a very fun experience. And I love them both so much. So I can't wait to have that experience with them. How can I make this about me? No, but I'm planning on wearing a white dress. No, I'm just joking. That'd be absolutely psychotic, but I'm very excited. Anyway, that is my good thing. And if you've made it this far, thank you so much for listening. I hope you're kind to yourself today and you do something nice for yourself because you're special and you deserve it. Anyway, if you'd like to hear a bunch of bonus content, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival that you'd like to share with us and possibly hear on an upcoming listener's episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We have a TikTok that is Not Today Podcast and a Twitter that is Not Today Podcast, but the T on the end of podcast is a 3 because that makes sense. And just keep breathing. Yeah.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.